Today's program was brought to you by 100 Bogart Street, the brand new co-working space in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Learn more at 100bogart.com.
I'm Massimo Bottura.
Hi, this is Amanda Cohen.
This is David Kinch.
This is Mike Anthony.
This is Huni Kim.
This is Amanda Freitag.
This is Richard Blaze.
This is Paul Kahn.
This is Curtis Stein.
This is Stephen Harris.
This is Missy Robin.
This is Phil Rosenthal, and this is an open kitchen episode of Andrew Talks to Chefs.
I think in the last couple of years, since I've started doing more work on cookbooks, I think of myself more as somewhere between a professional cook and a home cook, because I'm taking these ideas from the professional kitchen of prep heavy, work light, or, you know, just getting your mise en place together, or thinking about how you can take three disparate ingredients and combine them. But I'm translating that for the home cook. And it's right now, it's immensely satisfying because I get to create dishes and put them out there for people.
That is Chandra Ram, the editor of Plate Magazine, our guest this week on an open kitchen episode of Andrew Talks to Chefs. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the show. This is Andrew Talks to Chefs. I am your host, Andrew Friedman, and I am here with Caitlin Friedman. Although, Caitlin, whenever this show airs, you're not here.
That's true. I'm far away in Europe.
We always pre-record, but it's usually like maybe a day before the show goes up.
Right.
We are banking an intro with you as you get ready to leave for this trip that we mentioned at the end of the last show.
Yes.
And as we sit here, we are not sitting here.
Where am I?
You're somewhere in Europe.
Maybe I'm in Nice, just about to come back.
No, it'll air before that. Paris.
Maybe I'm in Paris.
You're in Paris. Don't fall in love over there.
I really won't.
It's your first time.
What if I...
Your first time in Paris should be with me.
What if I re-fall in love with you while I'm in Paris?
How would that happen exactly?
Because I'll miss you.
Aw. You're such a good liar.
I'm not lying. I'm being totally serious. Over the steak frites, I'll be like, "Aw, Andrew."
Oh, Andrew likes steak frites. Andrew likes foie gras.
Okay.
All right. So, well, in any event, our guest this week, Chandra Ram. Have you met Chandra?
I have not.
Okay, this is another one of these weird things. I've only met Chandra a few times, but you know how it can be sometimes. You have sort of an instant kinship
now
with somebody.
Now you feel like you've known her forever.
Forever. So. Yeah. Chandra is the editor of Plate Magazine, which is a trade magazine. A lot of people listening to this show may know it. We get into what exactly it is in the interview. But, you know, I created this category not long ago when we had Phil Rosenthal on, of open kitchen.
Yeah, I love these.
And the idea is it's someone who is not a chef, but who I thought would have some relevance to our audience and that people who listen to this show would be interested in. Chandra does edit a magazine, but she actually used to be a working cook and went to the Culinary Institute of America. She also has a journalism degree. Ended up choosing this side of the fence, the writer's side of the fence. We met years ago. She was, when the Beard Awards were still in New York, I still can't believe they're not here anymore. They're now in Chicago. And she just, you know, looked me up, said, "Can we meet?" And we had a drink. And I think we've probably met a handful of times since then. Really not more than that. But given the shortness of our relationship, I was quite touched that not only did she interview me at a bookstore last week, Read It and Eat, in Chicago, but she and her husband, Jay, put me up.
So nice.
So nice.
Yeah.
And
I need to meet this person.
Yeah. Well, next time one of us is in the other city, we'll make sure that happens. And Jay, if you're listening, which I doubt, but maybe you are since Chandra's the guest, thank you for putting me up and for coming to that bookstore event. So with that, I'm going to get us right to our interview with Chandra Ram, recorded when I was in Chicago the week of October 1st. Here you go. How long have you been with Plate Magazine now?
I have been with Plate for 15 years.
What?
I started writing for it 15 years ago when the magazine started. I developed a recipe for the first issue and then became a regular freelancer. I've been the editor for almost 13 years, which I believe makes me either a unicorn or a dinosaur. I'm not sure which one.
You have this unusual to me dichotomy in your life. You have been a cook.
Yes.
Professionally.
Yes.
You also went to journalism school.
Yes.
And now you write and edit. And I am always amazed when those two disciplines can exist within the same cranium. Because most cooks, as you know, are not, first of all, they barely got out of school, a lot of them. A lot of them, not everybody. But a certain amount of restlessness, you know, I've always said, you know, the chefs who write their own books, active chefs who write their own books, kind of blow me away, because most chefs can barely sit still long enough to write an email, right? Like texting was the greatest thing that ever happened to cooks in terms of communication.
Because, yeah, I mean, the ability just to write, boom, boom, boom,
not
boom,
even
boom.
Okay, the ability to write the letter K, signifying okay, is a great thing for most cooks.
But I think that there is, there's a commonality to me in what the product is, because whether you are...
Product meaning food or
what
prose?
You're producing, yes. Because whether you are writing or recording an interview with someone or putting a plate up to the pass...
Yes.
Your, all of your perfectionist instincts, my perfectionist instincts, come into play, and then they have to be dismissed because it has to go out. There is a hard deadline. There is a server at the pass saying, give me the plate.
Right.
Or there is a newsletter that has to go out or a magazine that has to be printed. And so you do it. You do the best you can. It is both our combinations of art and something, whatever's on the other side of the brain, whether it's science or structure and grammar.
Craft.
And then you put it out.
Yeah.
And as I like to say, if it's a magazine, it could be lining the bird cages.
Right.
If God help me, you have bird cages.
Right.
And if it's food, then your best case scenario, let's just say it's gone in 24 hours.
Correct. Yes.
So for me, it is, you know, when I talk to chefs, I love it when chefs nerd out on a particular technique, or they go super, super deep on a technique, because...
You mean when they're talking about
When they're talking about it. And, you know, and that's executed in their cooking, but I'm like, that's kind of how I feel about the collective pronoun and the use of the collective pronoun.
Right. For me, it's the series comma or the Oxford comma.
The Oxford comma, which we could do an entire separate interview where we just talk about how that should be used and whether it should exist.
I don't even know if she listens to the show, but the woman who edited my book, my Chef's Drugs and Rock and Roll book, Gabriella Doob, we bonded over our love of the Oxford comma. What, I don't even know if people know. So when you write, when you list a series of things, at least when I was in school, you were taught... that you had the option of having a comma before the and.
Right.
Right? So I like pizza, burritos, and ice cream, right?
Yes.
Now, unless you could grammatically confuse that sentence, if you didn't have a comma there, whether or not you had a comma after burritos or not was up to you, right? Because the and separates the things.
Right.
Okay. My feeling has always been... You should always put the comma because it takes the decision making out of it.
Right. It's like the famous book Eats, Shoots, and Leaves.
Is anyone still listening to this episode?
Now that we've cleared away all the casual listeners.
So you like when people geek out. Well, chefs geek out though. Like but what we're talking about is doctrine, right? Like a really stubborn doctrine and for writers. I think when chefs geek out, it's almost like it's like infatuation. Like they become smitten with a technique.
Right.
It's a different thing. Am I making sense? Is this what you're talking about?
Yeah.
Like they'll see something. I've seen cooks see something in like a book, right? A cookbook. Mm-hmm. And they'll be like, that is so hot.
And you then know? They're just
and
like
they pass 100% it around.
All over it. Yes.
Yeah. And then they want to maybe try to imitate it or do something that riffs on it. But I think grammar, it's more... Like, for me, it would be actual writing that I would have that response to.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they're all of those different parts of it. And for me, it was something where I didn't go into culinary school thinking I wanted to run a restaurant.
Okay.
I actually... I used to work in catering.
Yeah.
And I kind of thought, oh, I'm going to be a caterer and I'm going to have a specialty food store and merge those businesses.
Yeah.
And then, thank God, when I was in culinary school at the CIA, I worked for someone who had that exact business.
Yeah.
And we catered, we were one of the preferred caterers for West Point.
Okay.
And so we did all the weddings at West Point.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, man. Drunk cadets and spurs, mooning the grandparents and all of those things. And then just all of the good things that you should know about getting into that business, which is buying an utterly crappy old van and it immediately smelling like the eggs that spilled on the ground that you were actually, or on the floor of the van that you were never able to get out. And so I thought, okay, kind of not thrilled with this. I had already studied journalism and I just didn't think that I could become a food writer necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
And so the fact that I do it now sounds like it was all this like incredibly well-planned endeavor.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it wasn't, but it was the same mentality, I think, that at least now all the chefs I know who are my age kind of lament that no one does this anymore. But it used to be when you're in a kitchen, my first restaurant job was omelet girl. My first cooking job was omelet girl on the hotel buffet line at the Embassy Suites in South Portland, Maine.
Wow.
I hope everyone who ate there enjoyed their omelets.
Wow.
And
was that a Sunday only thing?
Oh, it was an every day of the week thing.
Every day of the week, there was an omelet station?
See? Now you're probably going to go there.
I'm going to go. You usually have to go to a Four Seasons for that.
No, no. Wow. But the thing was, okay, I want to get off of this omelet line. So I'm going to go in to the kitchen and when it's slow and see if I can learn how to do this.
Okay.
And then I'm going to clock out, but I'm going to stay for lunch and I'm going to help out the lunch cooks.
Right.
And then, all right, I'm too junior to be, you know, my first year to be of any help really at New Year's Eve, but I'm going to stay and I'm going to cook and I'm going to learn how to do things.
Mm-hmm.
And so that to me is how you're supposed to behave as a cook who wants to learn.
Yes.
And the same thing for as a writer. As a writer, you need to just start doing it.
Yes.
And these days, of course, you can write and you can post it to anything. You don't even have to have an assignment, but of course, I am very respectful and of people, of the fact that everyone needs to earn a living. But it's just that, you know, people talk to me and say like, well, you know, you write so much. How do you do that? I'm like, you just write. And you know that. I mean,
well, sometimes I go through periods of incredible non-
Oh, well, you write and then you have your days where you can't write and it's full of all the self-loathing and
yes,
that.
That's the
and
term.
Then the next day.
The term self-loathing was created for writers. I believe.
Oh.
By writer, for writers.
By writers, for writers, 100%. But then you have that crazy productive day where it's like you write and write and write and it totally works. So ideally there's a balance.
Yeah, the writer's high. I call it the writer's high.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's the best.
Where it's like you didn't actually do any work. Like you were possessed in a good way.
Right.
And then you kind of come to and there's material in your Word document.
Yeah.
Right? Where you're not even thinking.
Right.
Yeah. But let me ask you a question. That you just said you can write and post anywhere now, right? And I'm saying this as someone who has a blog. But I know people say this is, and I do understand why it's really good, right? Because there's a democratization that happens, right?
It's
you can get your stuff out there. But my feeling is it's not all good.
Because
my feeling is, especially now that everything can look good, you know, like you can have no credentials and maybe no talent. That's the more important thing because you always need your first credential.
Right.
But you could have no talent. You could have an invalid, unthought out point of view, but you can have a slick website for not much money. And you can, if you're good with social media and, you know, you can draw a following. Is that good? Is it good that bloggers are hitting restaurants up, you know, for free meals?
Oh, God, that is awful. Bloggers,
but that happened. I don't know if people, chefs who are listening know this, but people will unashamedly write a restaurant and say, hey, I have a blog. I get this many hits per month. I want you to buy me dinner, and I'm going to write about it.
Right. And I felt like that was, especially a few years ago when Instagram influencers really came up, that was one of the biggest things that friends of mine who were chefs asked me about. They said, okay, this person wants to come in and they're going to Instagram the food and they want me to give them a free meal and however many gift certificates.
Yeah.
And I was just or
thousands of dollars. I mean, I can't say who. There's a prominent photographer in New York. I don't know if it's still done, but this person used to charge, you know, a couple thousand dollars to post a photo of people's dishes to their Instagram. I'm deliberately not even using gender, but to their Instagram account.
And it's something that to me, I find it kind of disgusting because I like the work. And I'm realizing that a bit. Because I've been working on cookbooks.
Yeah.
And I realize I really enjoy the work. And if you don't enjoy the work of actually writing about food, then just, I don't know, get the hell out of here.
Okay.
Right. Why are we faking what's like kind of the coolest job you can do?
It is cool. I mean, it's fun.
Right.
It's fun. Everything about it is fun. So, okay. Before we go any further, let's do two things. First of all, for people who don't know, go ahead. Plate Magazine.
Plate is a food magazine. It's geared towards chefs.
Mm-hmm.
What we do is that nerd out deep dive. So we publish 6 issues a year, and each one is focused on a single topic. So it can be about something. It can be about a region of the world. Yep. We've got an issue about Peru and its food and the influence of its ingredients all over the U.S., We just put out an issue all about foods of the Jewish diaspora all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
We did an issue about rice and its place in cuisines.
Yep.
So it can be, you know, it'll vary from issue to issue, but we really look at finding topics that are of interest or timely. Something that is not so broad that you're not pulling some very specific information out of it, but also not so specific that
you alienate people
or that it won't support a full issue because we are so recipe heavy in any issue, we're going to have say 50 recipes.
Right.
So it can't be something where, you know, the Peruvian issue, we hung on to that idea for probably 5 years. Cause I was like, all right, I don't want any ceviche.
Right.
What does this magazine look
like? Right, right, right.
So it's a little bit of a dance. And so we could cover something like the concept of all day dining, very high level things that chefs are doing to eliminate waste in their kitchens by actually cooking the scraps and the bits and pieces and that. Or like I said, it can be very focused on what's happening with Mexican food.
Yes.
And how did Mexican food become acceptable as a fine dining, you know, cuisine in American eyes when easily, well, I mean, it still happens now, but easily in major cities, even people were sitting down to Mexican restaurants and saying, where's the free chips and salsa? And, you know,
100%.
Where's all the crap? And what it means, you know, that is, you know, this is a food cooked by immigrants largely.
Yeah.
And how do we as a culture show respect for that and not just, you know, the white guy's food? So we'll, you know, we'll pick 6 topics that we think are going to be cool and interesting for chefs. And then we also have a lot of what I call high functioning foodies. As subscribers and people who go to our website and get our newsletters and that. And those are the people who have like the Viking 6-burner stove they buy all their pans from that one shop in Paris that sells all the copper, and they've got sous vide machines and, you know, they
get serious home cooks.
Yeah. Serious home cooks.
Yeah.
They're really into that because a lot of the consumer food magazines do have to cover the, here's a great stuffing for Thanksgiving and here's some cool Christmas cookies and more lifestyle food.
Yes.
Whereas we can be straight up like, we kind of don't even care.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Great.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, I love it. I contributed to
the California issue, which was just another sort of out there topic, but it was, hey, California has a huge impact.
Yeah.
On the answering the question, what is American food?
Totally.
So.
Yeah.
I don't know if you know this. I don't know if that came up when you wrote your giant freaking book about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It didn't have everything to do with defining American food, but that's, which is news to some people. But let's talk about how you got to where you are. So tell us, where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Lexington, Kentucky.
Okay. And what was that like?
It was...
You may be the only person I know from Kentucky, ever.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, someone I knew, someone who I've known enough to know where they're from, yes, I'm almost sure of it.
Well, and people, I don't necessarily sound like I'm from Kentucky because my parents are immigrants, mm-hmm. so, and they both had relatively British accents. Uh-huh. My father was Indian, and so, and he was of the generation, he was 12, 13 years old when India got its independence from Britain. Mm-hmm. And my mom's Irish. And so I didn't necessarily, I'll pick up an accent when I get home, but I mean, I grew up in a very academic-minded family.
Mm-hmm.
I think we definitely identified more as being Indian because my father has a huge family, mm-hmm. and we went to India every other year growing up. And so like all Indian children, I was supposed to be a doctor or a lawyer or an engineer. So
that sounds like a cliche, but there are cultures in this world where that is still very true.
And I was very fortunate that my parents were open to other things. Mm-hmm. And
oh, so your extended family thought that way, but your parents...
I think just in the culture at that time,
yeah.
I knew a lot of Indian kids whose parents said, you are only going to college if you are pre-law or pre-med.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah, right.
And, you know... And P.S., you're living at home. Mm-hmm. Whereas my parents, you know, both grew up in very small towns, moved to London, met there, defied a lot of societal norms and people by getting married, mm-hmm. and then they moved to the U.S. And I think they were just both saying, like, hey, let's try this, let's do this. And
how'd they end up in Kentucky?
They originally moved, they moved from London to Cleveland. Uh-huh. So my father could, he was a doctor and he was finishing his PhD.
Got it.
And so he was at Case Western, mm-hmm. and then was looking, had finished up his residency and was looking for a place to go and got an offer from, the University of Kentucky Med Center and the VA hospital, which is connected to it.
Yeah.
And just said, this looks like a good place to raise kids.
Right.
And I'm a big, I love college towns, and that's what I grew up in. So I love those, like, my favorite places.
Yeah. Why'd you love, what do you love about, you just love the energy?
Yeah, I just kind of love the vibe of it. I love that it's a smaller city, but mm-hmm. it still has a lot of good restaurants and culture and that sort of thing.
Would it, like, clear out in the summer? Was summer drastically different?
It didn't feel drastically different from my point of view. Mm-hmm. I think right around the university it was.
Right.
But, yeah, so I just love going back, and you know, there's football games, and uh-huh. where I'm from, it's all about basketball.
People you're into are still, all that.
I'm somewhat into all of that, but again,
are like you like a different person when you're there?
No,
you said you can you turn the
my
accent on.
I don't turn it on; it just happens.
Really?
Yeah.
So can you do it on demand?
Well, I mean, if we got my friend Ingrid on the phone, she lives in Nashville.
I'm not going to do that.
If I talk about her long enough, it'll probably happen.
Well,
but.
Okay. We're not gonna do that.
My parents, though, also said, like, here's the rule. You're not going to college in Kentucky. They were the only parents who were like, get out of here. Mm-hmm. Because they just wanted my brothers and me to experience other cities mm-hmm. and, you know, see what it was like to live someplace else and check out another culture, whether it was a big city or a small town.
Okay. And what did you think you were going to do? Did you think you were going to be a reporter?
I actually have been hoarding magazines since I was a teenager.
Really?
Yeah.
Which ones?
Oh, just all like the girl magazines, like the, it was Young Miss,
uh-huh.
and then I think it became Young and Modern.
Okay.
Mademoiselle.
Uh-huh.
I read Cosmo until my parents found it, which I can only imagine what they, what was going through their heads. I think there was something that was like a precursor to Teen Vogue.
Okay.
I mean, I loved fashion and all of that. And so I loved magazines. I loved Life magazine. I probably
I used to love Life magazine.
There's like a solid decade of Life magazine
yeah.
that I probably read about 50 times.
Wow.
And I read Ladies Home Journal. I would read everything.
Did you have like a hero or a heroine? Was there someone you were like, I want to be that person?
You know, in my 20s, I really loved Liz Tilberis, who used to be, she was the editor-in-chief of British Vogue.
Okay.
And then she moved to the U.S. and became the editor-in-chief of Harper's Bazaar.
Okay.
And she absolutely remade that magazine.
Right.
And very sadly died of ovarian cancer. And I read her memoir and I just thought, this is the coolest thing ever.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and my mom was a great cook.
Yeah.
My mom was the mom in the 70s, 80s, who's like, okay, I just bought a wok and we're having a dinner party it's on. And yeah, by the way, we're in Kentucky and no one knows where, which is ironic because now there's a great Japanese food scene in my hometown.
Is that right?
Because there's a Toyota plant just outside. And so you can actually get really good Japanese food.
Your mom was on the sort of, so she was like on trend. Like she was one of these people in the U.S. who was swept up in the food scene.
Yeah, and I don't know if she necessarily identified herself as like, oh, I'm super into food. Well, I mean, she was. I remember thinking how glamorous and exotic it was that my friends would get Campbell's soup and a grilled cheese sandwich, especially a grilled cheese sandwich with American cheese, because my mom's Irish and she does not accept American cheese in her home.
Was it cheddar?
Yeah, like the sharpest cheddar.
Sharpest, whitest cheddar you've ever seen.
Right, which was not easy to find. I remember her looking at like containers of pimento cheese and just saying like, oh dear God.
So I thought you were going to say you felt like it was exotic at home because your friends were eating like the tomato soup and the grill. You meant the grilled cheese and the tomato soup to you was exotic.
That very American feeling was exotic because, you know, there's, especially in that time and place, but I think for any kid, all you want to do when you're growing up is fit in.
Yeah, sure.
And if you've got a funny name or brown skin or you're taller than most of the boys or anything that makes you stand out,
yeah,
I think is what you want to get rid of.
Wow. So was it hard for you being a kid?
It was just a constant state of feeling other.
Yeah.
We weren't Indian enough to fit in with the other Indian families because my brothers and I weren't raised Hindu.
Yeah.
We didn't speak any of the languages.
Yeah.
And we didn't grow up in that culture 100%.
Uh-huh.
But we were also stood out from the sort of all-American white people. So, I mean, I remember, strangers asking me. It wasn't an uncommon thing to have a stranger walk up to me at the grocery store and say, well, what are you?
Mm-hmm.
And
in a hostile way?
Not in a get out of my store way, but in a you're weird, you're different way.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
did you experience overt racism?
A little bit.
At school?
Not necessarily at school, but just around town.
Yeah.
For sure.
Uh-huh.
Probably mild levels of it. Certainly no violence, no anything like that. But my parents were huge proponents of long car trips in the summer.
Uh-huh.
Like the wood paneled station wagon and four kids crammed in there and all kinds of stuff. And I always remember once we were doing some sort of driving tour of the deeper parts of the South. And we weren't able to find a hotel somewhere, and it was going to be hours until we got to Florida. And my dad said, yeah, we're just going to drive through. And I asked him why, and he just looked at me and said, because there's just some people who aren't going to like your mom and me together.
Smart man.
And
in my opinion.
Yeah.
I would never, to this day, it's 2018, as a Jewish person, I would never drive cross country.
Wow.
I would never do it. Because of a moment like that.
Right. And I could see, especially, he did not want to expose his children to that.
Yeah. Yeah.
So there are things. But then again, it was a college town and we were, you know, a lot of my parents' friends were also, you know, other doctors at the hospital and things like that. So we were, I think, shielded from a certain amount of what racism could have been. Like a four-leaf clover, shining like a tiny bride.
landing on all four feet like a cat who's ready for a wild night.
My theme song and break music is from After School Specials album Double Barrel Single Entendre, which is available on iTunes.
100 Bogart Street is finally open and ready for Bushwick. 100 Bogart is a brand new, state-of-the-art co-working space that provides turnkey workspaces, including open layout desks, meeting spaces, and furnished private offices. Members have access to top-notch amenities such as custom furniture, high-speed internet, spacious kitchenettes with coffee and tea, printers, scanners, and much more. Alongside their professional work environment, 100 Bogart also provides exclusive educational programming for any curious entrepreneur. Heritage Radio Network has made their new office home at 100 Bogart and will host many events there in the future. For more information about their co-working space, visit 100bogart.com and become a member to network, create, and educate.
Welcome back to the show. We're going to get you to the rest of our interview with Chandra Ram in just a minute. Caitlin.
Andrew.
I hope you're having fun in Europe.
I can't wait to go back.
I'm treating you as a hologram now.
Really?
Yes.
Well, for now, I actually am.
How's your trip?
There. I'm having the best time.
Yeah?
A little tired. I've eaten too much.
Jet lag?
No, I'm doing okay with the jet lag. Okay. Maybe had a little bit too much wine.
Yeah?
Yeah, but I'm really enjoying it, and it's very productive.
Okay.
Because I am working. This is a work trip.
Oh, yes, I know.
Okay.
Yes.
Just to be clear.
Nudge, nudge, wink, wink.
No, I really
I know
am
it
working.
Is, but you're going to listen.
Yes.
Listen, I saw you pack that suitcase last night. You look like you were packing for like Oscar week.
That actually really made me laugh. Okay.
So it is a work trip, but there's some glam.
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm going to glamorous places for work.
Okay. So I hope you're having fun over there.
Thank you.
Everyone else listening to the show, as always, I'd love for you to keep up with us. You can follow us on Stitcher or iTunes. You can also follow us by following me on social media. The feed for this show on Instagram is at Chef Podcast. My personal feed is at Tokeland Andrew, TOQUELAND. Andrew, that's good on both Twitter and Instagram. And if you would leave us a rating or review on iTunes or Stitcher, it really does help people find the show, and I would really appreciate it. And with that, I'm going to get you back to my interview with Chandra Ram, recorded in Chicago the first week of October. I hope you enjoy the rest of it.
So you have this journalistic streak,
mm-hmm.
and then you would decide to go to the CIA.
Yes. So
how long after you finished journalism school did you do that?
Well, I studied journalism in undergrad.
Oh, okay.
And then
was that your major?
Yes,
it was. So it was an undergrad major.
It was an undergrad major. And I then kind of like bounced around a little bit. I have Irish citizenship, so I took advantage of that and went to London for 6 months mm-hmm. to bartend and mm-hmm. just work front of the... I worked in front of the house in restaurants for a long time and loved that. And then I took the super glamorous omelet cooking mm-hmm. job, as one does. And I think for me, because I wasn't particularly academic, the fact that I could go to what I felt was the single best culinary school in the country, and, you know, still feel is just the best culinary school. The fact that I could get into something like that.
Right.
And that was within my reach was very important to me. And I just said, hey, I just want to go to this one place.
Yeah.
And it was, it was just a really fantastic experience.
What year were you there, or years?
I was there in 97 to 99.
Uh-huh. Okay. Exciting time in American cuisine.
Exciting time in American cuisine.
Was it an exciting time at the school?
Not necessarily. It was still it was still an old curricula, so we learned the mother sauces.
Right.
You
were in a
bad
French cooking school.
I was at a French cooking school. Yeah. There were French chefs. There were German chefs. There was, one Italian chef, Papini, who would scream and throw things at you.
Was Tim Ryan in charge yet, or was it still Metz?
No, it was President Metz.
Yeah.
So it was very strict and mm-hmm. old school, and we had things that, class titles that make me laugh now. Even then, I was like, do we really have a class called Oriental Kitchen? And then we did international, which we did all of the other countries of the world in 1 week. You had Caribbean Day, and you had Southeast Asia Day, and you had India Day.
It says a lot. But it says a lot. But they were. But I've always felt that the CIA does try and has for a long time to stay current with what's going on in the supermarkets, in restaurants.
Oh, absolutely. So
I feel like at that time, that sounds very lame now to say what you just said, right? It sounds lame of the school.
It does,
but that was probably a good faith effort to give you all some kind of baseline in where things were going.
Yeah, absolutely. And what they were doing was a great job of setting us up also for what was new American cooking.
Right.
And so we had classes that focused on that. We studied regional American cooking. We got into that, like all of that awesome 90s food that I'm still pretty nostalgic for because
like
I think just the, like for some reason, something about the 90s and crepes to me go hand in hand.
Uh-huh.
I remember, you wrote the Gotham cookbook and I remember working for chefs who cooked straight out of that cookbook.
Oh, is that right?
Oh, yeah.
Did they try to go tall?
The tuna tartare, and they went tall with the plates, and it was, man.
It's not easy to do.
That is not easy to do.
Yeah.
That that entirely vertical presentation on the tuna tartare from Gotham.
Yeah.
So, but, and some of it's probably even carryovers from 80s of like pesto and sun-dried tomatoes and all, you know, goat cheese. Goat cheese for everyone.
Goat cheese for everyone. I think of the nut, when I think of the nut, I don't know. I have sometimes, even after writing this book, I get my time periods blurred a little bit. But I think there was a lot of silly stuff. Like I think of like wasabi mashed potatoes.
I remember
that kind of thing.
Patrick Clark from Tavern on the Green.
The late Patrick Clark, yes.
The late Patrick Clark, who was lovely.
Yeah, I never met him.
Was lovely in terms of when he was talking with us students and He came and he did mashed potatoes and it was five different types of mashed potatoes. So he did wasabi mashed potatoes and then he had
to have the roast garlic mashed potatoes.
He had roast garlic mashed potatoes. Sure. He had a chili mashed potato. Yeah. You know, he had like a purple mashed potato, which was probably assisted with a little bit of dye.
Yeah.
So we did all of those, and it was...
Well, no disrespect really to the late, great Patrick Clark. But,
not at all. That was the food of the time.
That was the food of the time. Yeah. And it was fun. I mean, it was fun. It was fun.
Mm-hmm.
The 90s were fun. The music was fun. It was a carefree time.
It was.
I keep, in this time we're living in now, I keep hearing, songs, driving around, and I'll hear songs from the 90s, and I'm like, God, we really...
We were all children who had no idea how bad it could get.
Yeah. Everyone was just making money and doing what they wanted and going to clubs. It was all fine. Okay. So when do these two worlds collide for you?
Well, I wound up, I was like classic young cook.
Yeah.
And I had the little beat up notebook in my pocket in the kitchen. And I would just write things down constantly.
Little sub recipes, dressing, sub-recipes, sauces,
lists, mise en place, checks, all of those things. And I remembered, so when I was in culinary school at the CIA and at most schools, you have to do an externship.
Yep.
And so I lucked into the externship of all time. Let me see if I can get this right, because I have said this many times, but not in a long time. My college boyfriend's soccer coach's wife's niece was dating a guy who had shown up at Thanksgiving dinner and made a really great salad.
Okay.
And so they heard that I was going to culinary school and said, are you coming back to Chicago for your extern? And I said, I want to come back to Chicago for my externship. And they said, well, you should call this guy. His name is Paul Kahn. And he opened a restaurant 3 weeks ago.
Wow.
And so I called Blackbird.
Uh-huh. This is, for people who don't know, Paul's one of the most prominent chefs in Chicago. And was on episode 6, I think, of this show. 5 or 6. We have an interview with
Paul. Which is a great interview with him.
Well,
and
you.
Should you ever want to read more about Blackbird, I wrote a a massive long form piece called Project Blackbird. You can find it on the internet.
Okay.
When I did, or it's an oral history with about 50 people who were there. It's nutso.
For what outlet?
For Plate.
For Plate. Yes. Okay. Great.
So, so I called Paul.
Yeah.
And they said, "Can we tell him what you're calling about?" And I said, "I'm calling about Mary." Who is now his wife. And so, of course, he immediately got to the phone. And I said, "Hey, so anyways, Mary's aunt suggested, Carolyn suggested I call you. And would you ever let me come and cook there?" And I think Paul was like, "All right, well, this is a weird phone call, but sure, I'll do this." And so I, you know, it's an utter toss-up. Do you do 2 years of culinary school, or do you spend, you know, 3, 4, 5 months cooking with Paul Kahn,
right?
And having this experience, Blackbird had just opened. The Chicago Tribune hadn't even reviewed it yet.
Wow!
Because this is back in the days of yore when people waited to review restaurants.
Yeah.
And I got to be there and cook with him and learn from him and get yelled at by him. I can tell you about the time that I cut the pate and I didn't cut in perfectly straight lines. Mm-hmm. So we had to sacrifice a piece of it. And we talked about the waste of labor and effort that move cost. And I can talk to you about the time I was making like a vinaigrette and I didn't use extra virgin olive oil. I used like the blend. And, but I also got to have this incredible experience of cooking, bouncing around to all kinds of different positions and be with these incredibly influential people when they were kind of interest to a lot of chefs. I remember when Charlie Trotter came in and everyone was like freaking out. But they were still these like, you know, as fancy as Paul and Donnie and Eddie and the late Rick DeArmet, who one of the partners, these four partners been together for 2 decades. Yeah. They're more like brothers. Rick very sadly passed away a few months ago. But I remember when, you know, Rick's mom would come in, make us egg salad sandwiches and help me roll Mignardise, truffles for Mignardise. And when they were fixing the plumbing problems themselves. And it was just a very, very cool experience.
Wow.
Going to the produce market with Paul before chefs really went to farmer's market as like a regular cool kid thing. While I was there, I they said, the PR person is coming in because we have to do like a local TV shoot or something like that. And I had taken some PR classes in college and learned about that as an option. So I just wrote this woman's name down and the name of the company.
Okay.
And then after after I finished culinary school, I worked for a year as a consulting chef.
Okay.
Which seems like, in retrospect, a super obnoxious thing for someone who's just graduated from culinary school to do.
I was going
to
say that. I wasn't going to say super obnoxious. I was going to say that's impressive that you could do that. Were you qualified?
Sure. I don't know.
Do you feel you did a good job?
I feel like I did a good job.
All right.
So but it was consulting for restaurant chains and manufacturers. Like, how many can we create some new recipes, 10 new recipes that are using the Chipotle Tabasco sauce?
Yes.
So it was those sorts of things. And it was kind of hand in hand with marketing, with the marketing team on that account. And I sort of hated that job because I traveled 5-6 days a week. And then I remembered I had this like crappy beat up vinaigrette stained notebook and I had the name of a PR firm in there.
Yeah.
And I called the PR firm and said, "Are you looking for anyone to work on restaurants?" And they said, "Yeah, we actually were just about to post a job thing."
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's life. It's with anything. Like, you've got to do the work and you've got to reach out and you've got to, and then you make your own luck in some respects. Or a certain amount comes to you. So I worked in restaurant PR for a few years. And
did I know this? I worked in restaurant PR.
I know you did. And
but
that
have
was
we ever had
something
this conversation? I don't think we did.
Well, I like to hide dark secrets from you. So,
yeah, well,
you
I used to hide this, but now I,
Well, and I was, when I transitioned into writing, you've come out very proud.
well, let's not get carried away.
But it is something that, you know, that's interesting. Well, you and I have talked about this, about how it feels when you, we were talking a few months ago about creating your book tour and promoting your book and how that has really helped. And I've thought about that because I'm writing cookbooks now and I'm like, okay, well, at least I know how to, you know, write a damn press release or something and or what to do. So I did that for a few years and kind of knew that this isn't where I wanted to end up, but it was a good place. And then somehow was able to transition into freelance writing while I was a publicist and just writing for publications. I would never, you know, would never be pitching. And I certainly never wrote about my clients or that. And then Plate was launching. And the founding editor, Nancy Ross Ryan, got some bad information about me. Someone told her I was an expert in fish sauce.
What?
And I wasn't an expert in fish sauce at all, but she called me.
Somebody must be.
Somebody is. Charles Fan is an expert in fish sauce. You know, Michael Galata is an expert in fish sauce. I'm not so much. But she called me and said, hey, can I interview you about fish sauce? I heard you're an expert. And I said, well, yeah. Let's talk tomorrow. Okay. And then I took off and I went to Borders bookstore and sat on the floor and read all these books about Vietnamese food.
Okay.
And then the next day I was able to give her a coherent sentence about fish sauce.
Okay.
And she said, wow, no one's been ever been able to really explain it so well, which is, I think, something a lot of writers and editors are come across.
Explain what? What it does?
What it does and how you can combine it with heat and with, you know, sugar and acid and what each component will do to it. And
I could have done that, though. Does that make you an expert on fish sauce?
It made me an expert of fish sauce in that moment.
Did you name, what's the Italian one? Did you talk about the Italian
no,
one?
No, I didn't even talk about garum or anything like that.
Yeah, right. Or what's the, what is, Colatura.
Colatura. Yeah. I didn't talk about any of the Roman sauces because she was very focused on Southeast Asian food, in Vietnam in particular. And, you know, as writers, we're always looking for somebody who can just clearly say the thing. It's so frustrating when you're interviewing a chef and you're like, dude, just put three words together in a sentence. So then she said, will you develop a recipe featuring fish sauce? And I said, sure.
Okay.
And then an issue later, they called and said, hey, that was really good. Would you ever write an article for us? And I said, absolutely, I will. And so I did, I became that, and they said, well, wow, we've got this person who went to CIA and she can write about cooking techniques. And we're launching this magazine for chefs. And so we'll have her write about cooking techniques. And so I did that for a few years. And then one day, Bill McDowell, our editorial director, who's still here, he called me and said, hey, Chandra, it's Bill McDowell, and I need to talk to you. And so I didn't call him back for 2 days because I'm a classic writer. Was like, oh, he hates everything I do, and it's terrible.
You didn't call back for 2 days?
Hey.
Wow.
And I called him back and he said, so anyways, we want to see if you want to be the editor of the magazine. So.
That's amazing.
And that, my friends, is how it happened. So
that's amazing.
The moral of the story being, anytime someone has the wrong idea about your level of expertise, go make yourself of an expert for a 10-minute conversation.
So this was all from the fish sauce ruse.
Yeah. I'm trying to think if I've ever told him all of this is a mistake, but. Oh,
that's pretty funny. That is pretty funny, isn't it? Don't you think?
It is. But it's also, I think it sort of speaks to, and you were talking about chefs and becoming infatuated with an ingredient a technique. And like right now, we did an issue of the magazine earlier this year all about the influence Japan has had on American dining. Under the idea that fine dining in America doesn't exist without such a huge Japanese influence.
Right.
And then even in more casual restaurants, people are doing this. So right now I think that chefs are infatuated with koji. And everybody is trying to figure out how to grow it in their kitchens and what it does and what they can do with it. And it might all be for a fried chicken sandwich. But, you know, you become infatuated with something and you learn all about it and you might stick with it. You might pivot to the next thing.
Right. So how do you identify? I mean, you've had this job for a long time. Do you still think of yourself as a cook?
I
don't. Do you think of yourself as a dormant cook?
I don't because... And I always try and correct people when they say, oh, Chandra's a cook, or God help us all, Chandra's a chef.
Right.
Because I have way too much respect for the people who are living and breathing it on the line every day.
Right.
Cutting and burning themselves and working through it and then unclogging the drain at the end of the night or whatever. I think it's good that I've had that experience.
Yeah.
That I've had the deep fryer start to leak uncontrollably at the beginning of the shift.
Yeah.
And I've been in that world. I know how I have jumped on the dish station more times than I can tell you and all of those things. But I don't. The last couple of years since I've started doing more work on cookbooks, I think of myself more as a... somewhere between a professional cook and a home cook, because I'm taking these ideas from the professional kitchen of prep heavy, work light, or, you know, just getting your mise en place together, or thinking about how you can take three disparate ingredients and combine them.
Yep.
But I'm translating that for the home cook.
Right.
And it's right now, it's immensely satisfying because I get to create dishes and put them out there for people. And not a lot of cooks get to do that.
Yeah. Well, this goes back to the very beginning of our conversation, right? The product. You talked about the two products. The two products.
I was going to say, are we going to talk about collective pronouns?
No.
I'm here for
it. No, we're not. I don't know if anyone's heard the last 40 minutes after we went off on all that. But if anyone's still here. No, but the product. You talked about the product.
Right.
And the products have merged for you.
The products have merged for me. So like I said, it's all like, you know, my mother, my poor mother, because my father passed away 30 years ago. My father passed before I finished high school.
Wow.
And so my poor mother had to explain to our relatives in India that I was going to learn to be a cook, which at the time in India was not something you did if you came from an educated family at all. And so it's one of the things that really resonated for me with your book was, you know, all of these guys and women, you know, you describe it almost like coming out of, of like telling their families, oh God, I'm going to be a cook.
Yeah.
And so my mother was just like, oh, you know, like my in-laws are going to think I'm like destroying their grandchildren's lives by letting them become, you know, letting her become a cook when she should be doing something very academic or getting married or doing whatever. And so I remember her calling me and she would say, okay, so wait, so is it Paul Bocuse or Paul Bocuse? Because she was trying to explain what the CIA was and how this was kind of a legit thing. So I think now she feels like, see, it all worked out.
Now, how much more respectable would what you ended up doing have been to the crowd overseas?
Oh, I mean, they're hugely supportive of it.
No, but at the time, because you said not going into like medicine or something.
Yeah. I mean, I think that that was just what they wanted. But we were always very different there because we were the American cousins, my brothers and I. And so it was, you know, I came from this very kind of strict, very academic family, and we were just doing things very differently, but they were like, well, you guys are Americans, so it's different.
Right.
So it's, and you know, in any case, I can blame my oldest brother. He didn't become a doctor, so, you know,
Got
he
it.
Set the rest of us on a wayward path.
So are you, do you consider yourself a Chicagoan now? You must.
I do, but that's a very recent thing.
Really? That you felt that way?
Well over a decade, I was a Kentuckian living in Chicago.
Mm.
And I think it's, you know, I don't, it's something in the last several, I would say in the last decade that has really kicked in for me of just how much I love this city.
Yeah.
I mean, I get an enormous kick driving up or down Lakeshore Drive. I mean, you're driving on this road. The beach is right next to you.
Right.
It's, you know, you've got the city coming up either ahead or behind you. It's hard to knock that. It's really hard to knock
this
that.
This city to me has always, I haven't been here in a long time, but, well, not that long, a couple of years. But when I think of a great American city,
I think Chicago. Like, I think there are things about New York, San Francisco, L.A. They all have so many elements to me of otherness about them, right? Mm-hmm. Like, New York to me feels like a real city of the world.
Absolutely.
It's like a sister city to London. You know, those two cities are in their own ways kind of connected to me, right? Mm-hmm. And then San Francisco is like the Wild West out there, you know, and then LA, the architecture alone, you know,
right.
As what do they say in Annie Hall, like Spanish next to this, next to that. But Chicago to me feels thoroughly American.
Thoroughly American, very Midwestern.
Yeah.
Very.
Totally.
Take us as you see us.
Yeah.
Very, very friendly. One of the things that that marks Chicago style of driving is that we will let people in yes. front of us.
Yes.
But you have to give the hand wave. You have to just give a little high sign. I see right. that you just let
something
me in
that
front.
You usually do only when you're boating.
Right, right. But Chicago is a boating culture in its driving. It's a special thing. We don't tell many outsiders when I'm going to let you in.
We were on a boat last weekend. I hadn't been on a boat in a while. And, you know, the people who took us out, our neighbors, were like, you know, you just wave to everybody.
Right, right.
Why?
I don't know, but it reminds me.
I mean, I grew up in Florida. We did it there, too. But it's like,
well, that's the thing. I grew up in Kentucky.
Because everyone's so happy to own a boat.
I like, guess, yeah. You're like, hey,
right.
I'm on a boat drinking a beer.
Right.
Life can't be that bad.
Right.
But, you know, even when I'm home in Kentucky at my mom's, when I go for a run, someone drives past me, they wave and I wave. I love that.
Yeah.
I ran a half marathon in Alaska once, and I was out in Alaska to judge a Copper River salmon cooking something or other.
It was.
Yeah. Who says no to that? And they said, well, we're going to have the Copper River Salmon Marathon and Half Marathon.
Uh-huh.
And so I ran this half marathon, which was awesome. They drove us, you know, they drove us 6.5 miles out on some road.
Right.
And said, all right, every 4 miles, there'll be someone with a pickup truck with some
right.
Gatorade.
Right.
And said, there were like 25 of us. They yeah. said, all right, see you in a couple hours.
Wow.
Every now and again, you come up against a bald eagle and you're just like, you're really beautiful. Please don't kill me.
Right, right.
But like in Alaska, same sort of thing. Everyone waved when they passed
yeah.
you.
It's nice. It's nice. It's nice. The New Yorker in me thinks it's, I do like it.
Right.
I do like it. I do like it. I've run now. We live in the suburbs and, you know, there's a trail and, you know, you do the little wave. I'll wave. People say good morning. I'm not, it's more involvement.
I don't
want
to talk
handle.
To you.
Yeah. I nod.
Yeah, it's still a city here. I don't want to talk to you. Right.
I'll acknowledge our common humanity.
But
yes.
I don't want to talk to you, especially if we're sitting next to each other on an airplane.
Exactly. Well, thanks for doing this. We've done an hour already.
Good Lord.
Good Lord.
We could keep going.
We could, but we got to go do a bookstore.
Right, we got to turn the tables. I'm going to interview you.
Turn the tables. All right, thank you.
Thank you so much.
And that's our show for today. Caitlin.
Andrew.
I look forward to your return. I miss you.
Okay, thanks for holding down the fort.
Yes.
I'll be home soon.
You didn't ask, but things here have been okay. I'm a little overwhelmed as I get into the, you know, fifth or sixth day of being alone with the kids and the new dog.
Yeah.
You know, in the middle of your trip, I'm going to Vegas. It's been a lot. I'm a little tired.
Well, I appreciate it.
I'm a little tired.
I'll be back soon.
I'm a little tired. But, you know, you'll be back soon and we'll do something fun.
Yeah.
Okay. Chandra Ram, thank you for taking a chance at being a guest on the show. Caitlin, thank you again. Vitor, our engineer, thanks, Vitor, for stitching this thing together. And to all of you out there in podcast land, thank you for listening. And we'll see you back soon on Andrew Talks to Chefs.